here. But Charles Holloway stood in the strange night for a long time, looking in at the empty shop and the two sawhorses, and the cold, waiting, Arctic coffin set there like a vast star of India in the dark. Chapter 6. Jim Nightshade stopped at the corner of Hickory and Main, breathing easily, his eyes fixed tenderly on the leafy darkness of Hickory Street. Will? No. Will stopped, surprised at his own violence. It's just there, the fifth house. Just 1 minute, Will, Jim pleaded softly. Minute? Will glanced down the street, which was the street of the theater. Until this summer, it had been an ordinary street where they stole peaches, plums, and apricots, each in its day. But late in August, while they were monkey-climbing for the sourest apples, the thing happened which changed the houses, the taste of the fruit, and the very air within the gossiping trees. Will! It's waiting! Maybe something's happening, hissed Jim. Maybe something is. Will swallowed hard and felt Jim's hand pinch his arm. For it was no longer the street of the apples or plums or apricots. It was the one house with a window at the side, and this window, Jim said, was a stage, with a curtain, the shade, that is, up. And in that room, on that strange stage, were the actors, who spoke mysteries, mouthed wild things, laughed, sighed, murmured so much. So much of it was whispers Will did not understand. Just one last time, Will. You know it won't be last. Jim's face was flushed, his cheeks blazing, his eyes green glass fire. He thought of that night, them picking the apples, Jim suddenly crying softly, Oh, there! And Will, hanging to the limbs of the tree, tight-pressed, terribly excited, staring in at the theater. That peculiar stage where people, all unknowing, flourished shirts above their heads, let fall clothes to the rug, stood raw and animal-crazy, naked, like shivering horses, hands out to touch each other. What are they doing? Thought Will. Why are they laughing? What's wrong with them? What's wrong? He wished the light would go out. But he hung tight to the suddenly slippery tree and watched the bright window theater, heard the laughing, and numb at last let go, slid, fell, lay dazed, then stood in dark gazing up at Jim, who still clung to his high limb. Jim's face, hearth flushed, cheeks fire-fuzzed, lips parted, stared in. Jim! Jim, come down! But Jim did not hear. Jim! And when Jim looked down at last, he saw Will as a stranger below with some silly request to give off living and come down to earth. So Will ran off alone, thinking too much, thinking not at all, not knowing what to think.
Will, please.
Will looked at Jim now, with the library books in his hands. We've been to the library, ain't that enough? Jim shook his head.
Carry these for me.
He handed Will his books and trotted softly off under the hissing, whispering trees. Three houses down, he called back.
Will, know what you are? A darn old dimwit Episcopal Baptist.
Then Jim was gone. Will seized the books tight to his chest. They were wet from his hands. Don't look back, he thought. I won't. I won't. And looking only toward home, he walked that way. Quickly. Chapter 7. Halfway home, Will felt a shadow breathing hard behind him. Theater closed, said Will, not looking back. Jim walked in silence beside him for a long while and then said, Nobody home. Swell. Jim spat.
darn Baptist preacher, you!
And around the corner, a tumbleweed slithered, a great cotton ball of pale paper which bounced, then clung shivering to Jim's legs. Will grabbed the paper, laughing, pulled it off, let it fly. He stopped laughing. The boys, watching the pale throwaway rattle and flit through the trees, were suddenly cold.
"Wait a minute," said Jim slowly.
All of a sudden they were yelling, running, leaping.
"Don't tear it! Careful!"
The paper fluttered like a snare drum in their hands.
"Coming October 24th.
Their lips moved, shadowing the words set in Rococo type.
"Cougar and Dark's Carnival! October 24th, that's tomorrow."
"It can't be," said Will.
"All carnivals stop after Labor Day. Who cares? 1001 wonders. See, Mephistopheles the lava drinker. Mr. Electrico. The monster Montgolfier."
"Balloon," said Will. "A Montgolfier is a balloon."
"Mademoiselle Tarot," read Jim. "The dangling man. The demon guillotine. The illustrated man. Hey!
That's just an old guy with tattoos."
"No!"
Jim breathed warm on the paper.
"He's illustrated. Special, see? Covered with monsters. A menagerie."
Jim's eyes jumped.
"See? The skeleton. Ain't that fine, Will? Not thin man, no, but skeleton. See? The dust witch."
"What's a dust witch, Will?"
"Dirty old gypsy."
"No!"
Jim squinted off, seeing things. "A gypsy that was born in the dust, raised in the dust, and someday winds up back in the dust. Here's more. Egyptian mirror maze. See yourself 10,000 times. St. Anthony's Temple of Temptation."
"The most beautiful," read Will.
"Woman in the world," finished Jim.
They looked at each other.
"Can a carnival have the most beautiful woman on earth in its sideshow, Will?"
"You ever seen carnival ladies, Jim?"
"Grizzly bears. But how come this handbill claims..."
"Oh, shut up.
You mad at me, Will?"
"No, it's just..."
"Get it."
The wind had torn the paper from their hands. The handbill blew over the trees and away in an idiot caper, gone.
"It's not true anyway," Will gasped. "Carnivals don't come this late in the year.
Silly, darn-sounding thing. Who'd go to it?"
"Me."
Jim stood quiet in the dark.
"Me," thought Will, seeing the guillotine flash, the Egyptian mirrors unfold accordions of light, and the sulfur-skinned devil man sipping lava like gunpowder tea.
"That music," Jim murmured.
"Calliope. Must be coming tonight.
Carnivals come at sunrise."
"Yeah, but what about the licorice and cotton candy we smelled? Close."
And Will thought of the smells and the sounds flowing on the river of wind from beyond the darkening houses. Mr. Tetley listening by his wooden Indian friend. Mr. Crosetti with a single tear shining down his cheek, and the barber pole sliding its red tongue up and around forever out of nowhere and away to eternity. Will's teeth chattered.
"Let's go home."
"We are home," cried Jim, surprised.
For not knowing it, they had reached their separate houses and now moved up separate walks. On his porch, Jim leaned over and called softly.
"Will, you're not mad?"
"Heck no."
"We won't go by that street, that house, the theater, again for a month. A year, I swear."
"Sure, Jim, sure." They stood with their hands on the doorknobs of their houses, and Will looked up at Jim's roof where the lightning rod glittered against the cold stars. The storm was coming. The storm wasn't coming. No matter which, he was glad Jim had that grand contraption up there.
"Night. Night."
Their separate doors slammed. Chapter 8. Will opened the door and shut it again, quietly this time. "That's better," said his mother's voice. Framed through the hall door, Will saw the only theater he cared for now, the familiar stage where sat his father. Home already. He and Jim must have run the long way round, holding a book but reading the empty spaces. In a chair by the fire, Mother knitted and hummed like a tea kettle. He wanted to be near and not near them. He saw them close, he saw them far. Suddenly they were awfully small in too large a room in too big a town and much too huge a world. In this unlocked place, they seemed at the mercy of anything that might break in from the night. Including me, Will thought. Including me. Suddenly, he loved them more for their smallness than he ever had when they seemed tall. His mother's fingers twitched. Her mouth counted. The happiest woman he had ever seen. He remembered a greenhouse on a winter day, pushing aside thick jungle leaves to find a creamy pink hothouse rose poised alone in the wilderness. That was Mother, smelling like fresh milk, happy to herself in this room. Happy? But how and why? Here, a few feet off, was the janitor, the library man, the stranger, his uniform gone, but his face still the face of a man happier at night alone in the deep marble vaults, whispering his broom in the drafty corridors. Will watched, wondering why this woman was so happy and this man so sad. His father stared deep in the fire, one hand relaxed. Half-cupped in that hand lay a crumpled paper ball. Will blinked. He remembered the wind blowing the pale handbill skittering in the trees. Now the same color paper lay crushed, its rococo type hidden in his father's fingers. Hey! Will stepped into the parlor. Immediately, Mom opened a smile that was like lighting a second fire. Dad, stricken, looked dismayed, as if caught in a criminal act. Will wanted to say, hey, what did you think of the handbill? But Dad was cramming the handbill deep in the chair upholstery. And Mother was leafing the library books. Oh, these are fine, Willie. So Will just stood with Cougar and Dark on his tongue and said, boy, the wind really flew us home. Streets full of paper blowing. Dad did not flinch at this. Anything new, Dad? Dad's hand still lay tucked in the side of the chair. He lifted a gray, slightly worried, very tired gaze to his son. Stone Lion blew off the library steps. Prowling the town now, looking for Christians. Won't find any. Got the only one in captivity here, and she's a good cook. Bosh, said Mom. Walking upstairs, Will heard what he half expected to hear. A soft, fluming sigh as something fresh was tossed on the fire. In his mind, he saw Dad standing at the hearth looking down as the paper crinkled to ash. Cougar, Dark, Carnival, Witch, Wonders. He wanted to go back down and stand with Dad, hands out, to be warmed by the fire. Instead, he went slowly up to shut the door of his room. Some nights, abed, Will put his ear to the wall to listen, and if his folks talked things that were right, he stayed, and if not right, he turned away. If it was about time and passing years, or himself, or town, or just the general inconclusive way God ran the world, he listened warmly, comfortably, secretly, for it was usually Dad talking. He could not often speak with Dad anywhere in the world, inside or out. But this was different. There was a thing in Dad's voice, up, over, down, easy as a hand winging soft in the air like a white bird describing flight patterns, made the ear want to follow and the mind's eye to see. And the odd thing in Dad's voice
was the sound truth makes being said.
The sound of truth, in a wild, roving land of city or plain country lies, will spell any boy. Many nights Will drowsed this way, his senses like stopped clocks long before that half-singing voice was still. Dad's voice was a midnight school, teaching deep fathom hours, and the subject was life. So it was this night, Will's eyes shut, head leaned to the cool plaster. At first, Dad's voice, a Congo drum, boomed softly horizons away. Mother's voice, as she used her water-bright soprano in the Baptist choir, did not sing, yet sang back replies. Will imagined Dad sprawled talking to the empty ceiling. Will makes me feel so old. A man should play baseball with his son.
Not necessary, said the woman's voice, kindly. You're a good man.
In a bad season. Hell, I was 40 when he was born. And you? Who's your daughter? People say. God, when you lie down, your thoughts turn to mush. Hell.
Will heard the shift of weight as Dad sat up in the dark. A match was being struck. A pipe was being smoked. The wind rattled the windows.
Man with posters under his arm.
Carnival, said his mother's voice. This late in the year.
Will wanted to turn away, but couldn't. Most beautiful woman in the world, Dad's voice murmured.
Mother laughed softly. You know I'm not. No, thought Will. That's from the handbill. Why doesn't Dad tell?
Because, Will answered himself, something's going on.
Oh, something is going on. Will saw that paper frolicked in the trees, its words, the most beautiful woman, and fever prickled his cheeks. He thought, Jim, the street of the theater, the naked people in the stage of that theater window, crazy as Chinese opera, darn odd crazy as old Chinese opera, judo, jiu-jitsu, Indian puzzles, and now his father's voice dreaming off, sad, sadder, saddest, much too much to understand. And suddenly he was scared because Dad wouldn't talk about the handbill he had secretly burned.
Will gazed out the window. There, like a milkweed plume, white paper danced in the air.
No, he whispered. No carnival's coming this late. It can't.
He hid under the covers, switched on his flashlight, opened a book. The first picture he saw was a prehistoric reptile trap-drumming a night sky a million years lost.
Heck, he thought. In the rush I got Jim's book, he's got one of mine.
But it was a pretty fine reptile.
And flying toward sleep, he thought he heard his father, restless below.
The front door shut. His father was going back to work late, for no reason, with brooms or books, downtown, away.
Away. And mother, asleep. Content, not knowing he had gone.
Chapter 9. No one else in the world had a name came so well off the tongue.
Jim Nightshade, that's me.
Jim stood tall and now lay long in bed, strung together by marsh grass, his bones easy in his flesh easy on his bones. The library books lay unopened by his relaxed right hand. Waiting, his eyes were dark as twilight, with shadows under the eyes from the time, his mother said, he had almost died when he was 3, and still remembered. His hair was dark autumn chestnut, and the veins in his temples and brow and in his neck and ticking in his wrists and on the backs of his slender hands, all these were dark blue. He was marbled with dark, was Jim Nightshade, a boy who talked less and smiled less as the years increased. The trouble with Jim was he looked at the world and could not look away. And when you never look away all your life, by the time you are 13, you have done 20 years taking in the laundry of the world. Will Holloway, it was in him young to always look just beyond, over or to one side. So at 13, he had saved up only 6 years of staring. Jim knew every centimeter of his shadow, could have cut it out of tar paper, furled it, and run it up a flagpole, his banner. Will, he was occasionally surprised to see his shadow following him somewhere, but that was that.
Jim? You awake?
Hi, Mom. A door opened and now shut. He felt her weight on the bed.
Why, Jim, your hands are ice. You shouldn't have the window so high. Mind your health.
Sure.
Don't say sure that way. You don't know until you've had 3 children and lost all but one.
Never going to have any, said Jim.
You just say that.
I know it. I know everything. She waited a moment.
What do you know?
No use making more people. People die. His voice was very calm and quiet and almost sad.
That's everything.
Almost everything.
You're here, Jim. If you weren't, I'd given up long ago.
Mom? A long silence. Can you remember Dad's face? Do I look like him?
The day you go away is the day he leaves forever.
Who's going away?
Why, just lying there, Jim. You run so fast. I never saw anyone move so much, just sleeping. Promise me, Jim. Wherever you go and come back, bring lots of kids. Let them run wild. Let me spoil them someday.
I'm never going to own anything can hurt me.
You going to collect rocks, Jim?
No, someday you've got to be hurt.
No, I don't.
He looked at her. Her face had been hit a long time ago. The bruises had never gone from around her eyes.
You'll live and get hurt, she said in the dark. But when it's time, tell me. Say goodbye. Otherwise, I might not let you go. Wouldn't that be terrible, to just grab a hold?
She rose up suddenly and went to put the window down.
Why do boys want their windows open wide?
Warm blood.
Warm blood.
She stood alone.
That's the story of all our sorrows. And don't ask why.
The door shut. Jim, alone, raised the window and leaned into the absolutely clear night.
Storm, he thought. You there?
Yes. Feel. Away to the west. A real humdinger, rushing along. The shadow of the lightning rod lay on the drive below. He sucked in cold air, gave out a vast exhilaration of heat.
Why, he thought, why don't I climb up, knock that lightning rod loose, throw it away, and then see what happens? Yes, and then see what happens.
Chapter 10. Just after midnight. Shuffling footsteps. Along the empty street came the lightning rod salesman, his leather valise swung almost empty in his baseball mid-hand, his face at ease. He turned a corner and stopped. Paper-soft white moths tapped at an empty store window looking in. And in the window, like a great coffin boat of star-colored glass, beached on 2 sawhorses, lay a chunk of Alaska Snow Company ice, chopped to a size great enough to flash in a giant's ring. And sealed in this ice was the most beautiful woman in the world. The lightning rod salesman's smile faded. In the dreaming coldness of ice, like someone fallen and slept in snow avalanches 1,000 years, forever young, was this woman. She was as fair as this morning and fresh as tomorrow's flowers, and lovely as any maid when a man shuts up his eyes and traps her in cameo perfection on the shell of his eyelids. The lightning rod salesman remembered to breathe. Once, long ago, traveling among the marbles of Rome and Florence, he had seen women like this, kept in stone instead of ice. Once, wandering in the Louvre, he had found women like this, washed in summer color and kept in paint. Once, as a boy, sneaking the cool grottos behind a motion picture theater screen, on his way to a free seat, he had glanced up and there, towering and flooding the haunted dark, seen a woman's face as he had never seen it since, of such size and beauty, built of milk bone and moon flesh, as to freeze him there alone behind the stage, shadowed by the motion of her lips, the bird-wing flicker of her eyes, the snow-pale, death-shimmering illumination from her cheeks. So from other years there jumped forth images which flowed and found new substance here within the ice. What color was her hair? It was blonde to whiteness, and might take any color once set free of cold. How tall was she? The prism of the ice might well multiply her size or diminish her as you moved this way or that before the empty store, the window, the night soft, rap-tapping, ever-fingering, gently probing moths. Not important. Far above all, the lightning rod salesman shivered, he knew the most extraordinary thing. If by some miracle her eyelids should open within that sapphire and she should look at him, he knew what color her eyes would be. He knew what color her eyes would be. If one were to enter this lonely night shop, if one were to put forth one's hand, the warmth of that hand would, what? Melt the ice. The lightning rod salesman stood there for a long moment, his eyes quickened shut. He let his breath out. It was warm as summer on his teeth. His hand touched the shop door. It swung open. Cold Arctic air blew out around him. He stepped in. The door shut. The white snowflake moths tapped at the window. Chapter 11. Midnight, then, and the town clocks chiming on toward 1 and 2 and then 3 in the deep morning, and the peals of the great clocks shaking dust off old toys in high attics, and shedding silver off old mirrors in yet higher attics, and stirring up dreams about clocks in all the beds where children slept. Will heard it. Muffled away in the prairie lands, the chuffing of an engine, the slow-following dragon glide of a train. Will sat up in bed. Across the way, like a mirror image, Jim sat up too. A calliope began to play, oh, so softly, grieving to itself a million miles away. In one single motion, Will leaned from his window, as did Jim. Without a word, they gazed over the trembling surf of trees. Their rooms were high, as boys' rooms should be. From these gaunt windows, they could rifle-fire their gaze artillery distances past library, city hall, depot, cow barns, farmlands, to empty prairie. There, on the world's rim, the lovely snail gleam of the railway tracks ran, flinging wild gesticulations of lemon or cherry-colored semaphore to the stars. There, on the precipice of earth, a small steam feather uprose, like the first of a storm cloud yet to come. The train itself appeared, link by link, engine, coal car, and numerous and numbered all asleep and slumbering dream-filled cars that followed the firefly-sparked churn, chant, drowsy autumn hearth-fire roar. Hellfires, chant, drowsy autumn hearth-fire roar. Hellfires flushed the stunned hills. Even at this remote view, one imagined men with buffalo-haunched arms shoveling black meteor falls of coal into the open boilers of the engine. The engine. Both boys vanished, came back to lift binoculars. The engine. Civil War. No other stack like that since 1900. The rest of the train. All of it's old. The flags, the cages. It's the carnival. They listened. At first, Will thought he heard the air whistling fast in his nostrils, but no, it was the train, and the calliope, sighing, weeping, on that train. Sounds like church music. Hell! Why would a carnival play church music? Don't say hell, hissed Will. Hell! Jim ferociously leaned out. I've saved up all day. Everyone's asleep, so hell! The music drifted by their windows. Goose pimples rose big as boils on Will's arms. That is church music. Changed. For cry-yay, I'm froze. Let's go watch them set up. At 3 a.m.? At 3 a.m.? Jim vanished. For a moment, Will watched Jim dance around over there, shirt uplifted, pants going on, while off in night country, panting, churning, was this funeral train, all black-plumed cars, licorice-colored cages, and a sooty calliope clamoring, banging three different hymns, mixed and lost, maybe not there at all. Here goes nothing. Jim slid down the drainpipe on his house toward the sleeping lawns. Jim, wait! Will thrashed into his clothes. Jim, don't go alone! And followed after. Chapter 12. Sometimes you see a kite so high, so wise, it almost knows the wind. It travels, then chooses to land in one spot and no other, and no matter how you yank, run this way or that, it will simply break its cord, seeking its resting place, and bring you blood-mouthed running.
Jim, wait for me!
So now, Jim was the kite, the wild twine cut, and whatever wisdom was his, taking him away from Will, who could only run, earthbound, after one so high and dark, silent, and suddenly strange.
Jim, here I come!
And running, Will thought, boy, it's the same old thing. I talk, Jim runs. I tilt stones, Jim grabs the cold junk under the stones, and lickety-split. I climb hills, Jim yells off church steeples. I got a bank account. Jim's got the hair on his head, the yell in his mouth, the shirt on his back, and the tennis shoes on his feet. How come I think he's richer? Because, Will thought, I sit on a rock in the sun. An old Jim, he prickles his arm hairs by moonlight and dances with hop toads. I tend cows. Jim tames Gila monsters.
Fool!
I yell at Jim. Coward! He yells back. And here we go. And they ran from town, across fields, and both froze under a rail bridge, with the moon ready beyond the hills and the meadows trembling with a fur of dew. Wham! The carnival train thundered the bridge. The calliope wailed.
There's no one playing it! Jim stared up. Jim, no jokes. Mother's honor, look!
Going away, away, the calliope pipes shimmered with star explosions, but no one sat at the high keyboard. The wind, sluicing ice water air in the pipes, made the music. The boys ran. The train curved away, gonging its undersea funeral bell, sunk, rusted, green-mossed, tolling, tolling. Then the engine whistle blew a great steam whiff, and Will broke out in pearls of ice. Way late at night, Will had heard, how often, train whistles jetting steam along the rim of sleep, forlorn, alone and far, no matter how near they came. Sometimes he woke to find tears on his cheek, asked why, lay back, listened and thought, yes, they make me cry, going east, going west. The trains of far gone, in country deeps they drown in tides of sleep that escape the towns. Those trains and their grieving sounds were lost forever between stations, not remembering where they had been, not guessing where they might go, exhaling their last pale breaths over the horizon, gone. So it was with all trains, ever. Yet, this train's whistle, the wails of a lifetime were gathered in it from other nights, in other slumbering years. The howl of moon-dreamed dogs, the seep of river-cold winds through January port screens which stopped the blood, a thousand fire sirens weeping or worse, the outgone shreds of breath, the protests of a billion people, dead or dying, not wanting to be dead. Their groans, their sighs, burst over the earth. Tears jumped to Will's eyes. He lurched. He knelt. He pretended to lace one shoe. But then he saw Jim's hands clap his ears. His eyes wet too. The whistle screamed. Jim screamed against the scream. The whistle shrieked. Will shrieked against the shriek. Then the billion voices ceased, instantly, as if the train had plunged in a firestorm off the earth. The train skimmed on softly, slithering, black pennants fluttering, black confetti lost on its own sick sweet candy wind, down the hill, with the boys pursuing, the air so cold they ate ice cream with each breath. They climbed a last rise to look down. Boy, whispered Jim. The train had pulled off into Rolf's Moon Meadow, so-called because town couples came out to see the moon rise here over a land so wide, so long, it was like an inland sea filled with grass in spring, or hay in late summer, or snow in winter. It was fine walking here along its crisp shore with the moon coming up to tremble in its tides. Well, the carnival train was crouched there now, in the autumn grass on the old rail spur near the woods, and the boys crept and lay down under a bush waiting. It's so quiet, whispered Will. The train just stood in the middle of the dry autumn field. No one in the locomotive, no one in the tender, no one in any of the cars behind, all black under the moon, and just the small sounds of its metal cooling, ticking on the rails. "Psst," said Jim. "I feel them moving in there." Will felt the cat fuzz on his body bramble up by the thousands. "You think they mind us watching?" "Maybe," said Jim happily. "Then why the noisy calliope?" "When I figure that," Jim smiled, "I'll tell you. Look." Whisper. As if exhaling itself straight down from the sky, a vast moss-green balloon touched at the moon. It hovered 200 yards above and away, quietly riding the wind.
"The basket under the balloon. Someone in it."
But then a tall man stepped down from the train caboose platform like a captain assaying the tidal weathers of this inland sea. All dark suit, shadow-faced, he waded to the center of the meadow, his shirt as black as the gloved hands he now stretched to the sky. He gestured once, and the train came to life. At first a head lifted in one window, then an arm, then another head like a puppet in a marionette theater. Suddenly, two men in black were carrying a dark tent pole out across the hissing grass. It was the silence that made Will pull back, even as Jim leaned forward, eyes moon bright. A carnival should be all growls, roars like timberlands, stacked, bundled, rolled, and crashed, great explosions of lion dust, men ablaze with working anger, pop bottles jangling, horse buckles shivering, engines and elephants in full stampede through rains of sweat, while zebras neighed and trembled like cage trapped in cage. But this was like old movies. The silent theater haunted with black and white ghosts, silvery mouths opening to let moonlight smoke out, gestures made in silence, so hushed you could hear the wind fizz the hair on your cheeks. More shadows rustled from the train, passing the animal cages where darkness prowled with unlit eyes, and the calliope stood mute, save for the faintest idiot tune the breeze piped wandering up the flues. The ringmaster stood in the middle of the land. The balloon, like a vast moldy green cheese, stood fixed to the sky. Then darkness came. The last thing Will saw was the balloon swooping down as clouds covered the moon. In the night he felt the men rush to unseen tasks. He sensed the balloon, like a great fat spider fiddling with the lines and poles, rearing a tapestry in the sky. The clouds arose, the balloon sifted up. In the meadow stood the skeleton main poles and wires of the main tent, waiting for its canvas skin. More clouds poured over the white moon. Shadowed, Will shivered. He heard Jim crawling forward, seized his ankle, felt him stiffen.
"Wait," said Will. "They're bringing out the canvas."
"No," said Jim.
"Oh, no."
For somehow, instead, they both knew, the wires high flung on the poles were catching swift clouds, ripping them free from the wind in streamers which, stitched and sewn by some great monster shadow, made canvas and more canvas as the tent took shape. At last there was the clear water sound of vast flags blowing. The motion stopped. The darkness within darkness was still. Will lay, eyes shut, hearing the beat of great oil-black wings as if a huge ancient bird had drummed down to live, to breathe, to survive in the night meadow. The cloud.